Thank you, Vice-Chancellor, for those words of introduction and for the invitation to give this lecture. I managed to remain under the radar for 5 years, but you got me in the end. And welcome to all of you. I'm thrilled that you're here and immensely grateful to you all for your support to me as family and friends and student practitioner and academic colleagues, and for your interest tonight in a topic which has been a focus of my research for many years. Michael, I think you've taken the first page of my lecture, really, but I will go through it. I'll go through it anyway. This lecture is perhaps more timely now than at any point since I took up my chair at Sussex, given that my subject is social work and that the profession and its education is going through a period of reappraisal and development. And, of course, this isn't an unaccustomed process for us. Each decade has seen tragic occurrences which have focused attention on the profession, on its training, and on its practice context. But arguably, there is a different quality to the recommendations now emerging, and to the support of sector leaders, including those in senior positions in universities, which gives us some sense of optimism, even if it's a cautious optimism, that some positive developments can take place. It will remain the case, though, that social workers must negotiate some of the toughest decision-making terrain. We're not the only ones, of course, and we don't do it on our own. But my starting point tonight is that professional decisions can be perilous journeys through sometimes unmapped territory, with few known routes, landmarks, or signposts, and undertaken sometimes with inadequate equipment in the most adverse weather conditions imaginable. This is some navigational challenge, and I want to explore what part law might play. Social work, law, and the art of navigation. There are both professional and personal reasons for the title of this lecture. I first encountered the legal rules for social work, and by legal rules, I should say, I don't just mean statute. I mean the whole range of statutory case law provision, guidance, policy and practice guidance, codes of practice, the whole range of rules that affect the framework, that influence the framework to which social workers work. But I first encountered those rules when, as an unqualified social worker, when you could be such a thing, which of course is no longer the case, I participate in the compulsory admissions of people to psychiatric hospital, an action in which social work is deeply implicated alongside doctors. I was very curious about the nature of the authority by which I was imposing, or which I could impose, a solution that involved curtailing somebody's liberty, and the weight of responsibility for decision-making that entailed. Then when, many years later, in 1982, I was involved in training as an approved social worker in preparation for the Mental Health Act, which was coming in the following year, I was lucky enough to encounter the very best of law teachers, people who made the legal rules accessible whilst respecting their complexity, who engaged with the critical and moral debates and the dilemmas inherent in their use. And I'm delighted now to see one of those teachers in the Supreme Court as its first and currently only female justice. I was at the same time, though, deeply engaged with the developing mental health survivors movement, challenged by the view of a survivor friend that if professionals wished to be allies of people who survived the psychiatric system, then they could not also be approved social workers and exercise those powers and duties. So the die was cast for an interest that's endured and grown as I've moved through professional practice and academic environments. I did reflect, Michael, as to where you might be wanting to move me on next, but I'm here for now. What is the nature of the relationship between law and social work, even in less dramatic and contested interventions than approved social work practice? And importantly, how can we help social work practitioners and social work students to understand and use that relationship? How do those mandates from legal rules fit and sit with other mandates, those drawn from moral rules and from negotiated, communicative, and relational engagement with the people with whom we work? And how should I make decisions in situations where there's no right answer, only options with different pros and cons? My thinking still is work in progress, and my research, of course, as many of you know, has been shared with my partner, Michael Preston Shute. He and I were both new members of staff in the social work team at Manchester University a long time ago, at a time when they had nobody to teach the law module. Perhaps it's understandable that as the last in, we got to teach the subject that nobody else wanted to teach. I hasten to add that we don't do that here in Sussex, but teach it we did, and then one thing led to another. My other companions on the journey have been Hannah and Sebastian, who are also here tonight. Hannah, when you complete your legal training, we shall have our own family version of the law-social work relationship. And Bas, your music making sustains us through everything that we do. Thank you. And my most recent companions have been my colleagues here at Sussex. And I have to say that I couldn't want for better. And I'm so pleased to be able to celebrate our success, the success that we so deserve. Two caveats before I go further. First, I'm a social worker, not a lawyer. I've learned a huge amount from those lawyers and lawyers in training amongst you here and elsewhere. Some of you have joined with me in trying to identify how one discipline operates in the territory of another. But my frame of reference remains firmly the practice of social work. Second, in selecting the metaphor of navigation and references to maps and compasses, I have to apologise in advance to any geographers, cartographers, orienteers, navigators, others, whose mathematicians even, whose tools, for my non-expert use of the tools of your various trades. My choice is driven by a lifelong love of hills and mountains, which was instilled very early through family history and culture, and by personal experience of the navigational challenges that they can pose. I have survived to tell the tale. My father became very deeply knowledgeable about the art of navigation whilst flying aeroplanes in the RAF in World War II. But he knew, and he taught me, that technical tools alone are insufficient. Also required are skills and judgment in observation and interpretation, courage and creativity in intervention, and sometimes a modicum of luck, or what some might call the grace of God. And in fact, he took his main direction from the stars. So, what do we know from our research? What do we know from research into law and social work? Law is at the heart of social work. Or is it? It's certainly seen as central to what social workers need to know. The Department of Health located as one of five prescribed curriculum areas in the social work degree and require that at least one placement, in at least one placement, students gain experience of statutory social work involving legal interventions. The QAA, Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education Subject Benchmark Statement, is more explicit still and does engage with some of the complexity that's embedded within this topic. But the relationship is contested, as exemplified by a debate that started over 20 years ago between Sir Louis Blom Cooper, who had chaired the inquiries into the deaths of Kimberly Carlisle and Jasmine Beckford in the 1980s, and Professor Olive Stevenson, who had, of course, been a member of the inquiry into the death of Maria Colwell in the early 70s, and indeed had submitted a minority report after the inquiry of that committee. They argued about what was at the heart of social work. Sir Louis maintained that if the social workers in those cases had done what the law required them to do, the children would not have died. He argued that law was the pivot on which social work turned. Olive responded that surely at the heart of social work is something else, an ethical duty of care. And both of those models have very different implications for how we engage with and use the law and what we prioritise in terms of the complex array of thinking that we engage in. Their views are perhaps encapsulated best in these quotes. Sir Louis, we are strongly of the view that social work can, in fact, be defined only in terms of the functions required of its practitioners by their employing agency operating within a statutory framework. Olive, the image of the social worker as an agent of the law is partial and dangerous. for it encourages a view of professional competence which rests solely or mainly on an ability to interpret and execute legal requirements, whereas in fact such competence rests on far wider abilities in which that elusive but crucial element of professional judgment is central. Michael and I argued at the time that both positions distorted the realities of practice and that the social work sits uncomfortably between the two polarities. But the debates have continued. Contrast, for example, the statement at the top: professionals involved in child welfare are not moral crusaders. They are empowered in law to act in certain prescribed situations in certain prescribed ways, no more, no less. Contrast that with: the law cannot tell social workers what they do in every circumstance. It can only set out a framework. Above all, the law cannot be substituted for sound professional judgment. And every major inquiry makes its own point about the law and social work. This is Laming in 2003, after the death of Victoria Clambier. The legislative framework for protecting children is basically sound. The gap is not a matter of law, but in its implementation. 6 years later, commenting on the state of child protection in England after the death of baby Peter, it is vital that all professionals with responsibility for the welfare of children fully understand the legislative framework in relation to safeguarding and child protection and have a clear understanding of their responsibilities in the process. For this exploration tonight, I'm going to draw on a number of studies we've undertaken, including latterly work that we've undertaken for the Social Care Institute for Excellence, SCI, and for SWAP, the Subject Centre, Higher Education Academy Subject Centre for Social Work, on learning, teaching and assessment of law in social work education, on a study of law, a study of how law knowledge is located in decision making by experienced practitioners, and currently some work being undertaken for the Department of Health in the field of law making in adult safeguarding. So these are the headlines from amalgamated from a variety of research studies. First of all, that students and practitioners also have great ambivalence about law. Its importance is recognised and respected, but at the same time it's considered alien and qualitatively different from other sources of knowledge on which social work draws much, much more confidently than it does upon law and with a much greater sense of ownership. Law and legal processes are not only seen as alien, but they're seen as hostile, a big stick to beat social workers with, a source of intense stress, an arena in which social work has limited credence and status. Law learning is experienced as one of the most difficult aspects of the social work degree. Students expect to find it difficult to understand and probably to find it boring too, but approach it also with high expectations that here at last some clarity is going to emerge. There is very little consensus about what forms a law curriculum for social work. There's a common focus, we know, on rules that mandate social work action in relation to work with children and adults, but a very variable focus beyond that on the broader territory: housing, education, welfare rights, domestic abuse, criminal law. The legal rules are often associated in people's minds with intervention that may not be welcomed by service users and carers, and this focus on the power to coerce can eclipse recognition of the ways in which legal rules also enshrine and promote justice and support professional interventions driven by a search for just practice. We know too that the legal knowledge you acquire on your initial qualification programme decays very quickly, and that experienced practitioners are not confident in being able to articulate that knowledge. And finally, that legal knowledge and law talk are by and large not centre stage, and that's putting it mildly, in the practice environment. Practitioners refer more often to procedures than to legal principles. Concepts rooted in law are used as a kind of shorthand without clear significance for action. An example might be duty of care, for example. Law only surfaces as knowledge of last resort. And what emerges from the amalgamation of the findings are four different orientations or ways of configuring the law-social work relationship. A rational technical model in which the legal rules are the driver of intervention. Evidence is sought that fits legal definitions. Technical knowledge is prioritised so that we can do things right according to the letter of the law. Contrasted with what could be called a moral ethical approach, in which the search for ethical practice is the driver and the determination of the right thing to do, integrating legal and moral rules to negotiate conflicting imperatives. We could perhaps link both of those to the extreme versions expressed by Sir Louis Blom Cooper and Olive Stevenson. Then it's possible to discern a rights justice-based model in which law is seen as a resource for securing user, service user and carer rights, legal rules for challenging inequality and injustice, for securing resources and building collective capacity are prioritised. And then finally, a procedural configuration in which the guiding text is the procedure devised by the employer, its interpretation of its duties and powers, and the way that decisions must be made around here. So, what do we make of these findings? Why should this be? How might we explain? Why should this be the case? There are a number of ways and a number of channels of exploration that I have begun to explore more recently. It's true to say that the emphasis on legal rules that we can currently observe the development of over the last 20 years or so draws very negative comment in the social work literature. It's seen as part of a general societal trend towards control and regulation. And Stephen Webb's analysis of the role of regulation in a risk society is helpful in pursuing this analysis. In a context in which everything is uncertain and much is feared, then rules become a source of comfort, a kind of bulwark against insecurity. And thus we see the proliferation of management accountability mechanisms, audit, inspection, regulation. Risk is defined, controlled, and managed through what he calls technologies of care for the governance of uncertainty through technical planning and rational problem solving. This leads to the frequently leveled charge that in this climate, it's not the right decision that's important, but the defensible one. The one that emerges from the risk assessment systems and checklists which are put in place to minimise the risk of practitioners missing something important. Arguably, from this perspective, risk has replaced need as the driver for intervention, and social work becomes a technical activity shaped by the tools it uses, which reduce scope for exercising discretion based on ethical and analytical engagement with the core issues. If we look, for example, at this quote from Nigel Parton, legalism involves the superimposition of legal duties and rights upon therapeutic and preventive responsibilities. The rule of law, as judged by the court, takes priority at the expense of other considerations, including that which might be deemed by the professionals as optimally therapeutic or in the best interests of the child. Thus, law is seen as oppositional to professional discretion, and practice is reduced to the process of gathering evidence to take into the legal arena. Campbell, writing more recently, continues the polarizing discourse. Developments in mental health legislation, by which he means the Mental Health Act 2007 and its amendments to the 1983 framework, now require social workers to balance agency and legal expectations with a rights-based approach to working with service users and carers, reinforcing, again, the assumption that law is antipathic to rights. And this oversimplification is not uncommon in social work discourse, but I reflect that it's strange that law has become associated with regulation and risk management when its language is, in fact, all about needs, when individual civil and political rights, at least, are embedded within it, and when the proper exercise of discretion is one of the fundamental administrative law principles which underpin decision-making. So let's go back to the second possible explanation. If we look at the further factor that might illuminate the research findings, could be the nature of the legal rules themselves, which at times, at best, are contradictory and, at worst, oppressive, and sit awkwardly with a profession whose code of practice embeds notions of protecting the rights and promoting the interests of those with whom we work. An often quoted example is the Department of Health guidance on the introduction of the 1989 Children Act, which said equal rights and gay rights policies have no place in fostering services. Asylum and immigration rules, more recently, are deeply inimical to social work values and, incidentally, have also been judged as breaching human rights. And such challenges to our thinking about the legal rules takes us deeper into questions about the nature of the law itself. Clearly, this is a huge topic and forms the life work of many others, and it's not my intention tonight to stray too far into the territory, but the search for explanation about social work's ambivalence about the law requires us to explore the contested nature of law itself and its relationship to other fields of activity and other fields of authority. Is law, for example, a negotiated consensus about the norms that should bind our behaviour, legitimised through citizen engagement with a process of deliberative democracy, thus ensuring that the law administered by the state reflects citizens' real interests? Or is it a machinery employed cynically by the state for the purposes of control, an instrument in the hands of dominant groups? Or is it a field of activity which is predisposed to autonomy and thereby therefore constructs its own reality through the colonisation of other fields, in our case, social work, to which it applies its own rules and conventions, making them amenable to legal intervention? Is it a protector of rights? If so, whose? Is it a means of securing justice? If so, what kind of justice and for whom? These are important questions because they influence how we approach and orientate ourselves to the core elements of our knowledge base. A further contributing factor in seeking explanation of the research findings is the organisational context of practice. As Liz Beddow comments, the profession of social work hovers in uncomfortable places, always caught between transformative aspirations and bureaucratic constraints. Allied to this focus on the organisational context, our understandings about how social workers use knowledge in the context of the practice environment. As I see it, absence of law talk doesn't necessarily mean that law knowledge is absent in what they do. It's absent in their communication about what they do. Their practice language is not conveying, arguably, what they know. And Jennifer Osmond and her colleague make this point. Practitioners in their study communicated their knowledge in a number of ways other than by formally naming it, through case examples, stories, metaphor, understandings that resembled legal knowledge but wasn't actually expressed as such. So this leads us, I think, to consider and to take further the discussion of the nature of knowledge synthesis that occurs in practice. Formal knowledge becomes subsumed, leading to an assumption that it's not being used, but actually it is there. The reality of its integration is more sophisticated than we might assume, and we will come back later on to that proposition. So, what really happens between law and social work? What are the dynamics of the relationship? Let's go back to that idea of social work decisions as a journey through tough terrain and law as a map that can help guide our way. I have to say my use of the metaphor maps and compasses is unashamedly Luddite, and that's not because if it demonstrates a reliance on old technology, that's not because I fear engagement with the new or mistrust it, but it's a deliberate choice. It is my view that it's important for social work that we don't rely on tools that do the job for you, but instead that we use those that require skill and judgment. Would we, for example, place our entire trust in sat-navs? You don't even have to know where you are with a sat-nav. The machine works it out for you and tells you what direction to follow. But it removes that element of judgment and takes us unthinkingly into danger. But let's consider maps as a practical tool. And you can see my history coming out here. I love Ordnance Survey maps. I could spend all evening reading them like a book, and I guess there may be others of you who connect with that. But let's think of maps as a practical tool to show us where a destination is, for example, to identify the routes to reach that destination, to show the obstacles that will occur and the ways around them, to identify the landmarks that we can look out for on the way. For example, law can help define in very broad terms the outcomes that we seek from an intervention. The five outcomes for children's well-being spelled out in Section 10 of the 2004 Children Act, for example. The goal of safeguarding and promoting the welfare of children in need in Section 17 of the 1989 Children Act. The duty to promote the welfare of disabled people in Section 29 of the National Assistance Act. It also defines some of the ways in which we can reach those destinations. It highlights the main roads, Section 47 of the Children Act 1989, the duty to investigate the likelihood of significant harm. Schedule 2 of the same Act, which sets out the kinds of interventions and services that might be provided to support children in need. The same goes for Section 2 of the Chronically Sick and Disabled Persons Act of 1970, setting out the range of things that might be appropriate to provide in relation to disabled people's well-being. It spells out also the more detailed byways, the policy and practice guidance on assessment and care management, the guidance on fair access to care services. You can see we drill down into the further reaches of the legal framework and the different categories of legal rules. It identifies alternative routes and explains what might be most suited to which circumstances. For example, in choosing between, in relation to a decision, an intervention with somebody who lacks capacity to consent to that intervention themselves, we might have recourse to Sections 5 and 6 of the Mental Capacity Act to intervene without their consent in their best interests. But if we intend thereby to substantially constrain their liberty, then we must look to the deprivation of liberty safeguards contained in an amendment to the 2005 Act by the 2007 Mental Health Act? Or should we look to the 1983 Mental Health Act itself and be looking instead for admission to hospital? These are difficult decisions, but the law sets out the options and looks in some detail with us at the pros and cons. And case law is often very useful as a means of identifying the kind of reasoning that we might go through as professionals. Law also spells out the landmarks to be observed, the grounds for intervention, the definition of a child in need, the presence of significant harm, the risk to health and to safety. Familiar landmarks along the way in identifying whether there are grounds to go down one track or another. And it identifies the obstacles that will be encountered, for example, discrimination, inequality, poverty, homelessness, violence, and the bridges and crossings that can be used to navigate around them. Anti-discrimination legislation, the law relating to housing, education, domestic violence. Importantly, it maps the general terrain. I love pictures like this. Excuse me for imposing them upon you. But it took me some while to learn how to read the contours of a map. When you can, it's very helpful in navigating the territory. The general terrain, the lie of the land in relation to human rights, the high ridges of the principles that are increasingly embedded in our legal rules and sometimes in new statute. For example, the core principles set out in the 2008 Code of Practice to the Mental Health Act as amended. The principles articulated in the Mental Capacity Act of 2005. Equally important are the contours of administrative law, which spell out the particular qualities that social work decisions must demonstrate. They must be based on full examination of the facts. Action must be taken within the law that is proportionate, reasonable, fair, accountable, and timely. But maps pose challenges too. The map is a map. It's not the territory, merely an attempt to describe to ourselves the landscape. And one can see law, arguably, in this way too. Before you can use the map, you need to understand the contours and the symbols in order to interpret their meaning on the ground. Legal terminology is a challenge in that respect to us, but it's not an insurmountable one. The map takes a vertical viewpoint, and unless you're in a helicopter, things look very different down there in the swampy lowlands of practice. Using the map requires a change of perspective to translate what we see into landmarks we might expect on our journey. The map may be out of date, certainly the case in relation to adult social care law, which is currently subject to radical reform proposals by the Law Commission, or it may be undeveloped in relation to some parts of the territory, as is the case with adult safeguarding. The absence of a legal mandate to investigate, a legal duty to investigate, potential cases of significant harm to adults doesn't mean that adults are not being safeguarded. It means that law has not yet caught up with practice. And then finally, we forget to consult the map. We get lost. We get seduced by alternative destinations. We get deterred by the scale of the ascent. Or we experience things that the map cannot show us, mist and bad weather and occasionally poor leadership. So using a map is a lot easier if you are more accurate if you have a compass, a tool to connect the map to the territory, to enable a bearing to be taken that demonstrates the way to go. It's a means of getting your bearings. The four orientations identified earlier, the rational, technical, moral, ethical, rights, justice, procedural orientations, can be likened to points on the compass, ways of naming and understanding approaches which are in dynamic relation to each other, and all of which assist the travelling social worker to identify and, importantly, to keep their bearings. North, of course, has a special function in determining direction, and we could debate, perhaps, if we had time, which orientation might be social work's primary source of reference. But even then, even with a compass, it's not simple. There are three versions of north: magnetic, grid, and true north. Your compass points to magnetic north. The magnetic variation between true and magnetic north varies from year to year and from location to location. Even if you know what the variation is, you have to remember whether to add it or subtract it to your bearing. You have to have at least a rough idea of where you are, and you might just have forgotten about that penknife in your pocket, the buckle on your belt, your mobile phone, all of which will affect the reading of your compass. Does this begin to sound just a little like social work practice? So, how can we understand and make use of our map and our compass? We do social work. We don't do law. Social work is the territory, and our relationship to law is a little like the relationship of the ground to the map. We take the map and the compass with us, but out there we have to interpret what they tell us, and sometimes we have to continue when the map runs out. And we're not really talking here about an interprofessional field, although, of course, there are times when social workers and lawyers work together, and some interesting research has been carried out in those interprofessional relationships. But the question in my mind is more one of how the boundaries of one discipline or the other are observed or transgressed. Does law import social work? Does social work import law? Do they both migrate into some kind of mutual space? It has been claimed that the space between the disciplines becomes a kind of contact zone where symmetrical relations are played out. The term interdiscipline, which comes from translation studies, is used to describe what's created in the space between two very clearly defined territories. And that's quite an attractive concept. Of course, codified legal knowledge doesn't become qualitatively different through its enactment in social work practice. But it is possible, I think, to argue that what is created through enactment is greater than the sum of the parts. Neither social work nor law alone can solve social problems, but they do share concerns for human relationships and the rights and responsibilities that govern them. And I was reading recently some accounts of lawyers and social workers working together in the Middle East peace process, where the suggestion was that the notion was that law was providing the leverage and social work was providing the agency for intervention. Or perhaps instead of assuming that law is received knowledge given to social work, it's helpful instead to engage with law as it's interpreted and practiced in the professional context. The concept of law in between, from Jeunesse and Grattet's work, leads us to consider the stage between intention and practice, and is useful, I think, in identifying some of the factors that influence operationalization of legal rules. Legal rules are given meaning through localized interpretation and application. And we're thus talking here about knowledge that's situated and contextualized by the circumstances in which it's used and potentially transformed by that context through a process of creative synthesis. This doesn't change the legal rules, of course, but it changes the particular components in the mix of legal rules at any one time. For example, the balance being struck between observance of different and sometimes competing rights under the European Convention, and the notion of what might be a proportional intervention in any given circumstance. And I think the fact that we can find evidence of this synthesis in the fact that we rely, sometimes unthinkingly, in ways that we've observed in our research, on imported language without connecting it to the legal concept that underpins it. An example we used earlier was duty of care. Another one might be best interests, which is governed by a complex set of legal requirements set out under the Mental Capacity Act and its code of practice, but in practice becomes synthesized with a range of other knowledge influences, and it's possible only then to discern the trace of that legal knowledge, which nonetheless has a potency. And there is further research evidence in the research of others. Jonathan Dickens, in research involving social workers, managers, and lawyers working together in the courts, explores the impact of intersecting discourses, welfare, law, and managerialism, and the nuanced relationships between them in the context of child welfare cases. He starts from an analysis of law and managerialism as aligned and welfare as paradigmically oppositional. But he then points to a range of evidence for a much more integrated picture that emphasizes the dynamic, mutually transforming relationship between the discourses and the way in which their interaction is reflected in and remade by the actions and accounts of professional groups and individuals about what they do together. He calls this uneasy interdependence. And Sue White advances a very strongly argued case for the permeability of one discourse to another, as evidenced in the case that she advances through the importation by law of sciences to produce a hybrid psycholegalism in child welfare. And she demonstrates that it's the sciences that provide the evidence on which legalism and legal decisions are based. And certainly, the current experience of debating what legal rules should be created to safeguard adults is demonstrating very clearly to me that the encounter between competing discourses of autonomy within law and protection within professional practice. So my argument is that in social work, our journey is inevitably guided by and influenced by legal rules, but that it is the ground and the conditions encountered on the ground en route that determine how we travel, and that each step involves a process of synthesis to do the right things right. So what might this mean for learning law? If we're right that law is integral to the social work decision-making journey, then this affects the pedagogy we use in helping students learn it. And we know from our research into the learning, teaching, assessment of law in social work education that the pedagogy we use, the learning approaches we use in helping students to learn, are as diverse as the curriculum and indeed as diverse as students' own learning preferences and styles. But SCI, Social Care Institute for Excellence, has invested energy and resource in the challenge. And I would like to pause here for a few moments to give you a taster of how we're trying to develop new approaches to law learning that overcome some of those barriers of stereotyping. So this is an opportunity, please, for some participation. We're going to do a very short piece of an online quiz. Any students who've been involved in my classes will have probably encountered this before. That means I can rely on you, of course, to give the right answers. But this is an example of a piece of work funded by Sky to produce some e-learning objects which help to reinforce and support certain aspects of law learning. We are, one of the pieces of work we're currently doing is to evaluate the impact on social work educators and their students of working in this way. So what I'm going to suggest is just for 5 minutes or so that we play one version of the Win a Million quiz, which is, I have to confess, not a million miles away from a popular television programme. And we'll perhaps take the social work practice element of the quiz. This is a multiple choice quiz. It gives you four possible answers, A, B, C, or D. I will press the button if you tell me which button to press, and let's just see how much we win. Okay, a social worker's ultimate accountability is to their employer, their code of conduct, their professional association or trade union, or to themselves. Any starters? Who wants me to press A? B? B. Some consensus for B. C? D? D. So B and D. Okay. Let's go for B. Is the right answer? What you get then, we won't go through these in detail because this is not a class in which you're learning about the law on social work practice, but the whole principle of the learning object is that you have to make a statement, you have to engage, you have to interact, you then get some feedback about whether your answer is the right or wrong answer, and you get to know why it's the right answer. So, 500, yes, £500. Let's try question two. The Data Protection Act allows service users access to all data held on them, allows service users to demand immediate access to data, allows service users access to data that the local authority decides does not fall within exclusion criteria, or allows service users to remove data from files. C, a big consensus for C. Any counter proposal? Let's go for C is the right answer. And it's the right answer because you get the reason. Let's try question three. The findings of complaints procedures are binding on local authorities, are advisory to local authorities, set standards for future practice, or should only be departed from with good reason by the local authority? B. Any advance on B? Some moves for D. Any BDs, BDs? What we can do, if you like, we can do a 50-50. Should we do a 50-50? Okay. Aha! Okay, I'm going to ask for a vote. I heard more Bs than Ds. Oh, it's the wrong answer. Okay, we know that the right answer must be D. Yep, because we took away two wrong answers. Okay. And again, the reason, this time importantly, and one of the things we tried to do is to embed case law also within the objects to broaden the sources and awareness of the sources of law. Which of the following does not require local authorities to establish advocacy services? The Adoption and Children Act 2002, Mental Capacity Act 2005, Disabled Persons Act 1986, or Valuing People? C. A. D. Ooh. Okay, show of hands. Who wants to vote for A? Who's voting for B? Who's voting for C? Who's voting for D? I think the C's probably have it. And it's the right answer. And we're up to £4,000. How long have we got, Michael?
Another couple of hours.
Equality strategies are required in relation to race, gender, disability, or all three? Some consensus for D, yes? Yes, is the right answer. Partnership with parents is required by and defined in the Code of Conduct, the Framework for the Assessment of Children in Need, the Children Act, or Working Together? C. C, any advance on C?
D.
Okay. I'm going to suggest that we perhaps look at one of these other, perhaps we should, if there's a split there, should we phone a friend? Okay. The phone a friend embedded here is getting an expert's opinion. The expert's opinion were devised by convening a group of social work educators and asking them this question. Not that they would define themselves as experts. They weren't necessarily teachers of law. So they say D. Should we go for D? Should we accept their view? And it is the right answer. We'll just do one more and then I can demonstrate the final feature. When is a local authority not liable for the actions of its employed social workers? When a social worker is acting as an AMHP, when a social worker is approving prospective adopters, when a social worker is acting as an appropriate adult, or when they're giving evidence in court? A. Okay. Is the right answer, although one could argue that there is a vicarious liability. I can see Gwyneth nodding. One could argue there is a vicarious liability by the employer. When can a local authority, and this is, I promise, the last one, when can a local authority not take resources into account? When deciding on eligibility criteria and assessing need, when deciding on what services to provide, when responding to legal rules, and when deciding on the number of social workers to employ. I can hear A, I can hear C. Some unsureness. Should we go for asking the audience? The ask the audience answers were embedded by convening a group of social work students and asking them the same question. They went for C. Should we try C? Is the right answer? Good. I think we should stop probably there and go back to finish off my the rest of my presentation. But you can see the way in which we try to break through some of those barriers, those stereotypes. We are prioritising some technical knowledge here. We're not saying it's all about critical reflection on the legal rules and their roles in society. There are some things we need to know. And the concept of legal literacy is one that certainly I as an educator, and I think some students too, have found helpful in beginning to work on what are the aims of what we're trying to achieve here and what the component steps on the way might be. So at the heart of learning is exploration of law as having relevance to our own purpose as social workers and to the lives of people with whom we work. And this involves critical exploration of the role of law in society, its juxtaposition and sometimes counterpoint to moral rules, and its role in promoting goals that are central to social work. And then building from this critical foundation, although in my diagram it's at the top, it is foundational in my view, we can then begin to build in additional components. We can ensure that we support social work students to develop clear knowledge about and understanding of the legal foundation to their powers and duties. But in my view, this must be decoupled from the realm of technical knowledge, which is assumed to give us control of outcomes and located much more flexibly within the communicative engagement of practice. We can broaden the curriculum to encompass not just social work powers and duties, and the approach based on that, but also one which raises the profile and relevance of broader legal rules with which service users and carers, and therefore we, must engage. We can identify the wide range of sources of legal rules. It's surprising how often support for an ethical practice, direction and commitment is found in policy and practice guidance, which will be on the shelf of an office somewhere, but isn't centre stage in our thinking. And indeed, case law too, as a source of legal rules which can be facilitative of an argued and considered approach. We can ensure that we include consideration of administrative law and of the law on social work practice, for which you've just seen a short demonstration, to create a framework for reasoning and decision-making skills that will stand scrutiny should social workers and social work students be challenged on their decision-making. And we can enable students to develop legal research skills that will enable them with confidence to search for the text of a new piece of legislation, to track down its associated guidance, understand the status of that guidance, read the case law that arises, to make law learning part of that cycle of continuous professional development, and encourage a reflexive approach to law in practice, which negotiates constantly between orientations to find a decision and a direction in each individual situation. Now, studying law in the classroom is a bit like trying to learn to map read without going outside. It can teach the main features, the contours and the symbols, but it's not the territory. And a major contribution to law learning must be made by practice learning environments in different times and in different contexts, in different ways, to all of these aspects and components of the curriculum. What students often find in practice, on placement, is practice driven by the procedural point on the compass and a lack of law talk, which leaves this aspect of their learning firmly embedded, the law aspect of their learning firmly embedded, sadly, in the classroom. Yet it's here in practice that there is the most potential for students to experience the interactive nature of the law in practice and begin to understand the process of interpretation and synthesis. In conclusion, I'd like to note that it's particularly well-timed to have placed my lecture on World Social Work Day, which has as its theme human rights and the contribution of social work. And the focus of my lecture this evening has been upon social work in our own national jurisdiction. And indeed, as Walter Lorenz says, social work has to constantly renegotiate its position in its host state nation. But there is much to be gained by global awareness and connectedness. Legal mandates for social work vary quite considerably, very considerably, around the world. And that variability reminds us that the law social work relationship is and will remain a dynamic one. Practice is above all driven by a deep engagement with injustice and exclusion and a commitment to action that can incorporate individual and collective well-being in the lived complexity of that experience. But I hope I've demonstrated tonight what roles law can play in that endeavour. Thank you for listening.